Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Gee, it's nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today on Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Ben Starr and Michael McHugh. Now, not too far away on today's program, we're crossing live to London. We were just chatting with Nigella before we jumped into Studio One today, and she's raring to go in a couple of seconds. All excited to talk to us here on the radio. We'll be chatting with the president of the Australian Traditional Medical Society a little later on, Sandy Rogers, all about the art of using lemons to get over colds and flus. Wendy Barrell's going to talk us through the topic of independent thinking in schools, and Tabitha Coffey will also join us a little later on as well. And for more information on anything you hear today on the program or in the past, jump onto mindfood.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, Michael, our very first interview. This is a big interview for us.
It is.
I love chocolate. I love watching TV. I love watching this woman on TV.
Nigella Lawson. Look, she's so popular all around the world. She's been to Australia many, many times. Last year, she was on MasterChef. And yeah, it's great to have her here as our very first interview on Mind Food Radio. So, Nigella, what's the weather like?
I'm in London. I'm in very, very cold, early morning London.
Well, I have to say, Nigella, when it comes to cooking, did you always like cooking?
Well, I'll tell you how, it was just slightly slower than that. I was just expected to cook as a child, and I was interested in food, although, funnily enough, not a great eater. But I liked, you know, it interested me in how it was cooked, and I thought about it. And then when I went to university, I found that just being used to cooking, being around cooking, made me the kind of, you know, the house cook. Also because, you know, I cook without a recipe and I cooked cheap food, as you have to. I mean, that taught me the most, because cooking on a budget is really the best way of learning how to cook, because you have to learn how to make things taste good when the, you know, when the ingredients aren't so fabulous. So that's really when I became aware that actually I liked cooking and it was what I did. It wasn't because I really wanted to. It's just how it came. I suddenly realized I was the one who cooked. And then I found, you know, when I left and started working, I don't know, it just was an interest. Plus, really, it's a very good way as a journalist of putting off writing. And when I was a columnist, you know, when I was an op-ed columnist, I found that I would often make soup, because that chopping and stirring, very good way of not getting that awful brain freeze that you can get as you just sit staring at a computer.
Nigella, is eating in bed your ultimate indulgence?
Well, I don't think it's such a terrible thing. Therefore, it doesn't. It's not the ultimate indulgence in the sense of like, oh, it's this forbidden, wicked thing. It is nice. You're always not meant to do it. I don't like eating knife and fork food lying in bed, because then it becomes uncomfortable. But, you know, spooning food, excellent. And no cutlery food, very good. I mean, well, a bacon sandwich, fantastic. At the moment, I'm going through a kind of phase of rhubarb yogurt with pomegranate seeds in it. And I spoon that as I watch TV very happily. My bedside table has got mustard, Tabasco, salt, pepper, some crushed chilies. I mean, it looks like part of the kitchen.
Now, tell us about your brand new DVD.
I so love it that the DVDs get in Australia, because in a sense, I feel that, well, I'm such a DVD person myself. I think there's nothing nicer, really, than lying in bed with a box set. But I feel the recipes are so varied in it, so that it kind of takes in the whole of life, you know, quick food, food you cook when you're stressed, food that you cook when you've got a bit of time, not necessarily in the kitchen, but that you can go and do other things. And I'm a great believer in, you either want to cook fast or you want things that don't need a lot done to them, and then do it all in the oven. So I'm pleased about that. So I'm really pleased.
Now, the flirtatious personality we see on TV, how close is that to the real Nigella?
I feel that once you get this whole thing about being in some way flirtatious or something, it's leapt on. My real feeling about that is that when I go around, and if I do whether I'm in England or Australia, or if I do a book signing, people who come to it, they don't have that view of me. They've seen me from the TV. I think it becomes a shorthand. The one thing I'm not is a vamp. If you start thinking that what people say about you defines you, you're in trouble.
So, Nigella, when you're on set, how do you handle all that beautiful food?
When I film, it's not that I eat the food there, it's that the hours are so long and you get so tired. So I'm getting very stressed and overworked and not sleeping enough. It's like someone's taken a bicycle pump to me.
So sorry for the interruption, but we have gone over time and we really do need to wrap
okay.
this up.
Well, Nigella and Michael, it looks like we're getting the wind-up, the satellite feed again.
Thanks, Nigella.
Bye.
And we've got 6 DVDs of Nigella's brand new DVD to give away if you go on to mindfood.com. Today, we are going to be talking about gratitude. And I really believe in life, gratitude is one of those things that is very unsung. And I think it should be practiced much more than perhaps as a community and society than we actually do, you know, are aware of.
You were talking about a story you ran years ago. Yeah,
that's right. And one of the very first editions, it even got a cover line. And the feedback we got was extraordinary because it is one of those things when you talk about, it makes you think. It just really just line in the sand makes you stop and think. So we've welcomed on to today's show Kerry Howe. She has a PhD and a lecturer in professional studies all about gratitude. And you've been working in this field for many years, haven't you, Kerry? Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yes, I have been. I've been working in this field for over 10 years.
For those of us, I guess, who have been living under a stone for a million years, what do you see or what is gratitude?
I believe gratitude is an acknowledgement of what one has received and an action to give back with acknowledgement of this.
So do you think each day people can acknowledge, you know, perhaps the gifts that they've been given and, I don't know, thank the universe or thank someone out there for that?
Yes, I think they can thank them, and also I'm arguing that it's really good to convert that into a practice where you're actually giving back to someone in a really deliberate way. And it doesn't have to be the person you've received something from. It can be towards somebody else. So rather than it being a nice feeling or something where you're just feeling blessed for what you have, which is the first step often, it's gratitude becomes true gratitude in the way I think about it, but when one gives back out of acknowledgement for that.
Do you think people, though, find it hard to acknowledge gratitude?
Yes, and they find it very hard. Many people do. Some people find it just the most natural thing in the world.
Yeah.
And as soon as they're reminded of it, they think, oh, that's right, that's what's missing in my life.
Yeah.
But for other people, it's got so many negative connotations that they find it really difficult to embrace.
Do you think some people find it difficult to even identify it in their own lives?
I think they might want to give a different name to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they find it difficult to appreciate what they've been given. I think that's a really natural human way to be in the world. But the word gratitude has so many connotations with being indebted to somebody, and they don't necessarily want to be indebted. So they feel that's really inaccessible, so they'd rather use words like thankfulness or appreciation, which has got less of that kind of connotation.
In a classroom environment, though, you have so many issues playing out at any one time. You forget about the word grateful. Sometimes teachers would say, well, they're just thankful that they got through the class type thing. I mean, how does it work in teaching and learning? I mean,
I think there's a number of things that take away our gratitude. And in the educational situation, I argue that one of those things is the way in which teaching has been constructed, because it's really teachers who are giving and students who are receiving, and yet gratitude is all about enlivening a dynamic where there's giving and receiving from both parties. So putting gratitude in there is actually helping the teacher become more conscious of what they receive, and that can often be numbed out by feeling burnt out or being too busy or being in a functional kind of relationship with their students where they've just got to get them to perform on tests and all that sort of thing.
What you're saying is it's a two-way street.
Yep. Often what's stopping them is the opposite of gratitude, which is the things that we've just talked about, like their sense of entitlement and also the sense that I'm there to receive, and as sort of where that can go is a resentment about what I'm not receiving. And gratitude is the opposite of resentment. So where there's resentment, you can't have gratitude, and where there's gratitude, you can't have resentment.
Well, we've been talking with Kerry Howells today, lecturer of professional studies at the Faculty of Education. And you know what, Kerry? We're grateful and we're showing gratitude that you've been on our program.
Oh, thank you. And I'm equally as grateful to you.
Thanks, Kerry.
Bye.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And on the line with us today, the author of The Girl with the Butterfly Tattoo. This is a brand new book and, of course, is written for young girls who are experiencing some of the biggest changes in their lives. Michael, you've got daughters.
I know. And look, as we all know, as parents, they don't come with a guidebook and, you know, wouldn't life be easier if they did? But this is, and, you know, we get so many books in our desk at Mindfood. Yeah. This is an extraordinary book, The Girl with the Butterfly Tattoo. It is all about empowerment. It's all about self-belief. And, you know, as girls are entering different phases of their life, I think, Danielle, you have done a wonderful job. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And I suppose I've written the guidebook, so to speak. I have two daughters of my own. I have a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old stepdaughter who lives with us full-time. And I've been a teacher in high schools for 7 years and worked with teen girls for the last 8. I knew, you know, that it was time to really give girls some solid strategies so that they could make sense of what is becoming an increasingly complex and changing world.
You know, Danielle, I have to say, I work in education as well. It horrifies me how many young girls I teach who have tattoos all over them.
Ah, so you're focused on the tattoo element of my title.
Yeah.
Look, girls do choose to adorn themselves in all sorts of different ways and express their individuality. But I've got to say, to me in education, it wasn't so much, you know, the piercings or the tattoos that concerned me as it was the toxic girl behaviour. And often, you know, girls can be looking like they're doing really well and they may be very well behaved in class and performing academically, but behind closed doors, they're silently imploding. And we know the statistics show us that so many young girls are dieting, are binge drinking on weekends, are engaging in really toxic self-talk that really limits their sense of who they are, and they define their currency as their looks, and I suppose that's why they try and enhance them in all kinds of ways, including in artificial ways.
You know, it's interesting. We just recently in Mind Food did a story on self-harm, and it's extraordinary the growth rate in teenage girls.
Yes, it is.
And they're intelligent girls. You know, these are girls that are doing well in school.
Yes.
And, you know, this was a whole kind of thing that's happening out there that we, you know, for me, I just wasn't aware of.
Yeah, I agree with you. The statistics show us that 1 in 10 teen girls self-harm as a way of dealing with their stress and anxiety, and that is an increase over the last couple of decades. Look, is that because we're now more open about talking about these things and reporting them? But certainly, I've got to admit as well, you know, as a teen girl growing up, none of my peer group engaged in this, yet many girls tell me today that they know girls who do self-harm. Why do they do that? They do that because they are a stressed and anxious generation.
Yeah.
Mission Australia every year do a research project on what's going on in the minds of young people, girls and boys.
Yep.
Every year for girls in particular, body image is the number one concern. Am I beautiful enough? Am I thin enough?
Yeah.
Well, I remember when my girl started year 7, and I remember talking to a mother, and she was telling us how many years her daughter had been coached. And I remember saying to my wife, Michelle, what does that mean, coached? I didn't get what she meant. But, you know, now this has become more of a norm where parents are spending huge amounts of money on these kids being coached so they get into better schools, and even when they're in the schools, they're still being coached. You know, there's an extraordinary pressure, as you say, in and around the whole academic world now.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And it isn't just academic coaching, although certainly that's also on the increase. It's the fact that we seem to overextend our children full stop. So many parents, you know, from very little will have their children going off to do a musical instrument, to do sport, as you say, to do academic coaching.
Yeah.
They might do some drama or some arts. That's all great, and it's wonderful to have a well-rounded child, but if it means that you're literally taxing them around every afternoon and they're tired and they're teary and they're feeling overwhelmed, then, as you say, maybe it's time for us to sort of step back a little and go, what really is important? And for children, often that's play.
Yeah.
Daniel, thank you. Look, your book, The Girl with a Butterfly Tattoo, has been reviewed in Mindfood. You can read the review in the latest edition of Mindfood and also on mindfood.com. Thanks a lot, Danielle.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I love some of the topics we get on our program.
Well, it's all about educating people, you know, and it's that whole thing, what Mindfood's about, smart thinking. And I think if you can empower people, you can get people to think for themselves. It's about knowledge. And we've got a really interesting guest today, a high school principal. So sit up, Ben.
Moving students from spoon-fed to independent.
That's right. I'd like to welcome to the show college principal and head of senior school at Masada College on the North Shore in Sydney, Wendy Barrell. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, how are you, Michael?
Now, tell us, you've had some really interesting, I guess, change over the last few years in and around educating the students.
we're trying to encourage students to value their own thinking and to realise that their thinking is to make it more creative and more empathetic, to be more problem solvers and not to look to the teacher for the answers, but to look to the teacher with questions. And we think the questions are probably more a reflection of their thinking than the answers in lots of cases.
Have you needed to kind of re-educate the staff then in terms of teaching principles?
Oh yes, we've done lots of PD with the staff. I mean, a lot of the practices they were doing anyway, but a more conscious way of doing it and embedding it really into everything we do. And we also have, you know, tried to educate the parents so that they can also echo some of the methods we use in the home as well.
So what does a culture of thinking look like in a school?
Well, it's visible. Another word for a culture of thinking is visible thinking. It's originated in Harvard and it was called visible thinking, and there's a visible thinking website. So it's visible in that there's thought, the children's thought process. It's not necessarily the end product that we're valuing. It's the process of getting to the end, if there ever is an end. So the thinking is visible in the classroom. It doesn't have to be the finished product that's valued. It might be their thoughts around the room. It's also seen in the language of the teachers. So even something as basic as what makes you say that is a core to a culture of thinking, to make children stop and think about what is the logic behind what they've said and justify what they've said rather than just throw something out just to go through the thinking process of how they got to that conclusion.
What about peer pressure in that though? Because a lot of kids act up, you know, within a peer pressure environment and sort of
that's one of the great things about a culture of thinking is that everyone feels that their thinking is valued and there's no shame in putting something forward because everyone's idea, if you can just say why you thought that, is valued. And also a lot of the routines have their thinking put on post-it notes and then stuck up so they can be anonymous as a thinker and with their ideas so they don't feel shy to put forward their ideas if they're just in an anonymous form to be discussed by the rest of the class.
So Wendy, when you compare yourself to other schools, do you think other schools allow a culture of thinking or they don't allow thinking?
Oh, look, I think everyone would be doing thinking. I don't think they always focus the children on their thinking and think about... We're trying to get the children to think about their thinking and be conscious of their thinking. I think that's one of the differences. And trying to... I mean, why we first came to it was also to move away from spoon feeding because I think a lot of schools... the children feel secure and the parents feel secure. The students have lots of notes, so it's about what the teachers can give. Mm-hmm. We're trying to move it a bit more into what the students can give rather than the teachers, more of the facilitator rather than the answerer of all their questions.
So how can parents support a culture of thinking at home?
By just doing that, not looking for just loads of notes as a reflection of how much the children have learnt in class.
Okay.
And also echoing that when the children say things to them, ask the same question, what makes you say that? The same sort of language that we're using.
Yeah. Wendy, thanks for being on the show today. I know it's fascinating, anything to do with education, and I think the approach you're taking with this whole culture of thinking is really exciting.
Well, thank you.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Michael, we're always interested in some of the stories that you get, and you've been chatting with Tabitha Coffey. You've been doing a big article on this.
We have, and we've followed Tabitha's career. Most of you would know her from Tabitha's Salon Takeover, it is a cool show where she goes into these salons and she makes them over. The salon owners often don't love it, but by the end of the show, you know, they love her, and they've kind of had this extraordinary transformation. So the thing is with Tabitha, she's here and she's travelling around New Zealand and Australia, and we're a great fan of hers, I've got to say, in Mind Food. It's very watchable. And welcome to the show, Tabitha. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Tabitha, I've got to tell you, everyone at the Mind Food office is so excited that we're talking to you today.
I love that. And I just got off a plane from LA.
Tabitha, we're great fans of Tabitha's Salon Takeover, but you're actually here in New Zealand and Australia with Joico, who you've worked for many years.
I have. I worked for Joico for maybe 12 years, and I'm back in Australia and New Zealand actually doing business classes for hairdressers, so I'm very excited.
And will it be like Salon Takeover, where you actually go into these salons and sort of, you know, see what's wrong and kind of point it out?
No, I'm not going into people's salons, although that would be fabulous. I'm actually just holding business classes for hairdressers. So, look, it's hard at the moment. The recession is really hard. It's all over the world. It's struggling for small business owners out there. So it's really just coming back home and being able to give, you know, tips and tricks and marketing advice and ways for people to actually stand out in the crowd so that they can keep their doors open and make some money and, you know, be the hairdressers that they want to be.
Tabitha, do most people, are they open to your advice when it comes to when you have to be really, well, so I suppose cutting and true to them?
Look, it's hard. You know, I walk, when I go in with the show, I go into these salons and they really only have a week, and I have a true week to take them over and turn them around. And I'm kind of like a mirror. So I point out all the things that they're doing wrong and all the things that they need to change. And it's really hard for people to internalize all of that and make the change. And that's where the resistance comes from. So some of them are really open to it. Some of them, you know, not so much. But as you guys watch the show, you see the people that really do make the change and it's really genuine, and you see the people that really don't make the change, and sometimes those people aren't around for much longer.
But those transformations, you know, the people that are really anti you in terms of what you stand for, coming in, you know, how dare you kind of change my world, change my business, they're often the ones at the end that are just so, you know, full of praise and thank goodness, if it wasn't for you, you know, my life would have been so empty. What is that like in terms of giving those people that complete new lease on life?
Look, it's amazing. You know, I take it really seriously. I know it's a TV show, but, you know, for me it's really serious, and it's actually dealing with people's lives and dealing with people's livelihood, and the stakes are really high for a lot of these people that I go into. So for me it's really serious, and when people do make a change and when they can keep their doors open and when they can make money and get their life and business back on track, you know, it's the best reward that I can get, because during the three seasons of the show, I'm in contact with probably 85% of the businesses that I've taken over. And I know, you know, how they're doing and the improvements that they've made and the fact that, you know, they're doing really well and they've paid down their debt and all of those kind of things. And it really is so incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, it's so good to hear that, because I think as a viewer, you think of those reality TV shows as so such a slice of time, that it's great to hear that there is that sort of follow-up and genuine interest from you.
You know, I'm a hairdresser, so that's what I've done for 30 years, and it's what I love, and I really do care about these salons. I mean, that's part of where my aggravation comes from and my angst, and, you know, where you see me get really kind of PO'd, that all comes from me trying to help these people. So I don't want the cameras to go down and then me walk away and not be there for them. So they have my cell phone number, they have my email, and I'm in contact with them to make sure that they're okay. And if they need anything, I'm always there to be a cheerleader for them.
Tabitha, thanks so much. And enjoy your stay. You know, you return to home in Australia and travelling around New Zealand. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Fantastic. Thanks for talking to me, and it's nice to be home.
This is an interesting interview, Michael. We've got Jacqueline with us on the line. Hello.
Yes.
And it's all about intimacy.
That's right. And Jacqueline is a sex therapist. And let's be honest, and we should tell our listeners, we've actually been giggling here like a couple of schoolboys going, we've got sex therapists on the line. But I've got to tell you, whenever we've done a story with Jacqueline or anything like that, it becomes one of our highest rating hits. So I'm really looking forward to this interview. Welcome to the show, Jacqueline.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now, today we're going to be talking about intimacy.
Yes.
Michael, you're blushing.
I haven't even said sex yet in these
blushes. I know, he's blushing.
It's pathetic, isn't
yeah.
it? But listen, how big an issue is this for couples in a relationship?
It's huge. I mean, intimacy is so vital to you as a couple. And if we look at what a relationship requires, it's like the three pillars. And one's companionship, sure, being friends. Another is being able to run, you know, to manage life together, the logistics and so forth. And the third one is intimacy, passion, love, sex, love and intimacy.
Yeah.
It's that differentiates your relationship from any other relationship.
Why do people, you know, in their relationships, they break down? Is it because of the sexual stuff? The intimacy is lost?
Yeah, it's very, very common. I mean, sex and money are the two main reasons why relationships end.
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, we seem to think that this one part of life, unlike all others, should just happen naturally.
and
be easy. You know, like, no one thinks you get wealthy without effort. No one thinks you stay healthy without effort. Yet for some reason we think we should just, like, naturally have an easy, uncomplicated, intimate life.
Do you think, though, this is part of society, though, you know, that we don't, I don't know, perhaps educate our kids at school, or we don't talk about it, just
absolutely.
Generally that...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I am very, very rare. There's virtually no one out there that actually teaches people this stuff. Mm. You get a lot of very... Okay, at school you don't get sex education. You get reproduction education. You learn how to make babies and not make babies. That's it. Nothing about love, intimacy, pleasure. Oh, no.
Well, because do you think that then falls into the realm of duty of care?
Oh, well, look, I mean, one of the problems that I've seen, because we don't give our young people proper sex education, you know, intimacy and pleasure education, they have to find it somewhere. So, you know, like, when we were young, there wasn't the internet, so we didn't know very much, but we had to basically go off and figure it out ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Some more successfully than others. What's happening these days, the kids aren't getting the education or the information that they need, so they turn to the internet, right? And on the internet, now I have nothing against porn per se, except that these days it's all that's available to educate people, right?
Mm, that's sad, isn't it?
Everyone's looking at porn and thinking that's what sex is, and it's not.
Mm. But how do we change that?
Well, yeah, that is a real challenge because, you know, I mean, from my point of view, one of the things that I say to couples right at the beginning is spend a little bit of quality time together every day.
Yeah.
Right? You'd be amazed at how many people don't even spend 15 minutes just having a nice chat.
Yeah.
You know, I say, sit down with a cup of tea, maybe when the kids have gone to bed, for instance, Or at some stage, make a cup of tea, sit down somewhere nice, maybe play the backgammon or whatever, and just have a chat.
Yeah.
You know, and start to remember why you liked this person in the first place.
But what happens when the chat's no longer there?
You may need to start, you know, doing things again that have commonality. Because, I mean, if you did marry someone for no reason other than you thought they were hot, well, that's pretty dumb. You know, like I said, there were three pillars, and one of them is friendship. You know, like, you do need to have interests in common. And it is true that people can grow apart.
Yeah.
You know, like, relationships can come to an end, and hopefully you can maturely say, look, it's been great, but we're not meant to be together anymore.
Well, unfortunately, in the words of Sarah Brightman, it's time to say goodbye.
Jacqueline, we could talk for hours. We're going to have to get you back on because there's so much we can talk about. But thank you very much for coming on the show today. For more information on Jacqueline and her book and site, go on to mindfood.com.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Well, now on Mind Food Radio, we have Lee Power. We're talking the big event of the Stroke Foundation coming up.
That's right, in Melbourne. And Lee, of course, is from Ginger Boy. And it's sort of a hawker-style food right in the centre there of Melbourne. How are you, Lee? Welcome to the show.
Very good. Thank you. How are you?
Good. So tell us a little bit about the concept, because I guess it's of Ginger Boy. It's very original and distinctive, isn't it?
It's based on the hawker style foods and the street stalls you'll find throughout Southeast Asia and China, in a sense. So, you know, really fresh, vibrant colours, flavours.
But they're in the laneways, aren't they, in and around Melbourne? You've got their huge big neon sign. You can't really miss it.
Yeah, definitely.
How many just sort of passerbys do you get, or do a lot of people kind of book and know that you're there?
We do allow for a fair bit of walk-in traffic and stuff like that. But we do take reservations especially. But obviously having that big red neon sign does draw people in. And
it brings you in. And it sort of has that intimacy, I guess, of Shanghai in the 50s. It's a very, you know, it's a beautiful kind of space.
Like a chocolate box scene.
Shanghai in the 50s sort of meets New York chic.
Yeah, it's pretty
in
cool.
In interior design, so, yeah.
Now, tell us about, you're supporting the National Stroke Foundation with a dinner in Melbourne. What are you going to be cooking on the night?
So we're doing Ginger Boy's signature son-in-law egg. It is a soft-boiled egg. And then we chill the egg down and then we flash fry it so the proteins in the egg white all actually blister. And so the yolk is nice and runny and the outside you have a nice crispy texture. And then that is with the house-made chili jam and prick nam pla. The prick nam pla is hot, sour and salty
Thai dressing.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. I want one of those now.
Is it hard to make?
I bet you
it sounds hard to make.
No, it's not hard at all. You pretty much soft boil your eggs. We use a timer and then we submerge them in ice water to slow the cooking process down. And then we'll peel the eggs and then fry the eggs in a wok at about 180 degrees. And then, obviously, we've pre-made the chili jam and the prut nam pla. And it's just about presenting the dish.
Mm-hmm. Lee, you're alongside a fairly impressive list of very talented Melbourne chefs. Is this the first time that you've done the dinner Food for Thought?
It is the first Food for Thought event that I've done. We have done other charity events and things like that, and we do continue to do charity events. But this is the first event that I've actually done.
Have you had anyone close to you or in your family that have suffered a stroke?
My grandfather on my father's side suffered a stroke. So,
okay.
Yeah, so I do know some of the effects and things like that can happen.
Yeah. And the dinner, of course, in Melbourne is on May the 24th. It's all the proceeds go to the National Stroke Foundation. It's a wonderful event, a fabulous event. It's on the calendar. And, of course, later on in the year, there's one in October, Sydney on October 4, and at Hobart in July the 19th. So, Lee, thanks for being on the show today. That recipe sounds beautiful. It's worth just going to eat that, don't you think?
Oh, I'm hungry already. Lee Power talking from Ginger Boy in Melbourne.
Thanks, guys.
For more information on today's radio show, visit mindfood.com.
Got today on the show Sandy Rogers, who is the president of ATMS, the College of Traditional Medicine. Hi, Sandy.
Hi there, how are you?
Very good. Now, how many years have you been practicing this?
Well, this year 33 years, so that says how old I am.
So you know your stuff.
Why is our immunity important?
Well, look, you know, one thing that people forget is that the immune system really has to do with every other system. So if the immune system becomes run down, then you're going to be more exposed to disease, illness, cancers. Most people think immunity, cough, colds, viruses, those sorts of things. But realistically, the moment that the immune system drops, every other system of the body is under pressure. So it's really important to focus on keeping that immune system running.
And are there certain foods that we should be eating, you know, to boost our immunity?
Absolutely. Look, the best way to get that immune system up and running and keep it running is using powerful foods as medicine instead of going to the health food shop to pop a pill or the latest immune craze that's out there in a pill or potion. Some of the best things that are out there are things like eating horseradish or having garlic, having the leafy green vegetables. Apples is perhaps one of the most powerful antiviral medications that we've got. So having the apple a day, which really does keep the doctor away because of its high-powered nutritionals. But the more colourful the food, the better it is for the immune system. So keeping that in mind is a good thing. But the other thing, you know, that detracts from immune function is attitude. People have got high stress, they've got a really lousy attitude, like the cup is half empty versus half full mentality. That really does affect the immune system as well. But in the food line, the more colourful it is, the better. The more spicy it is, the better. So it's a really simple way for people to think.
What about the weather? You know, as we sort of get into much colder, you know, we've had so much rain lately. What about the weather?
It's not so much the weather if we've got consistency, i.e., you know, it's cold every day or it's hot every day. But here in Sydney, I'm in Sydney at the moment, I come from Melbourne.
Yeah.
We've got all this rain up here, very high humidity, lots of rain, and then the body has to try and adjust and adapt to these climatic changes. So the really, the friendly part, if you will, of the immune system called the T helper cell, it's really trying to keep everything working. The B suppressor takes an opportunity, which is the bad guy, to overrun. So the more your body is struggling with climatic changes, then the harder your system is going to work. So therefore, you need to make sure you stay away from stodgy food, make sure you're really well hydrated and keep the body fairly warm, because warmth is assisting the immune system.
It's hard though, isn't it? Because, you know, when it does get a bit cold and drizzly, you immediately do want those fatty foods.
Yep.
The younger generations coming through, you know, these days are showing a lot more addictive personalities because of the lifestyles that they lead. And they really do neglect their sleep patterns, hydration. I mean, what advice do you have to people listening in today?
I think one of the biggest things that you've hit on there is that in the young consumer market, we're seeing less activity. They sit there with their iPads or sitting inside with computers instead of going out and running outside for 8 hours.
Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of skin conditions and a lot of bone conditions developing. So we need to get kids outside, running around more and getting more exercise.
So it's going to be a very interesting society, isn't it?
And so we need to get them away from the fast food and back to quality food.
Exactly.
Because basic principles are 200,000 years old, and that's, I think we're getting a swing back to that, though.
Fantastic.
I completely agree. Sandy, thanks so much for being part of the show.
You're most welcome.
Thanks again. We've been chatting with Sandy Rogers, president of the ATMS, and of course for more details on mindfood.com. Very interesting, wasn't it, Michael?
Look, it was, and I think there is a real resurgence of people heading back to those very traditional ways of living, you know, having a vegetable garden, you know, getting a compost heap, you know, and then really eating within season and being a lot more aware, I guess, particularly if you've got children, of how you want them to live. And look, it's hard, though.
I've
got three kids, and it's hard to turn that TV off and get them outside or take the game out of their hand. But I think as parents, that's where we've really got to head.
Now, if you missed one of our interviews today and you really want to hear it, you can jump onto mindfood.com. All those interviews are sitting up there as podcasts, available for your listening pleasure. And this has been another episode of Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking. Well, a busy program today. Nigella Lawson, we had Kerry Howell talking about what is gratitude. Wendy Barrell talking about independent thinking in schools. And of course, Jacqueline Hellier, our sex therapist with Tabitha Coffee. And of course, Sandy Rogers shows us the way of how to get over those winter flus using the art of lemons. Well, until next week, have a fantastic week, won't you? And don't forget to join us next time here on Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking at your radio station. And for more information on today's program, jump onto mindfoodradio.com. Have a great week.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.